The new book, A Spy in Canaan, explores the life, complex motivations, and legacy of the fascinating figure Ernest Withers, as well as the dark shadow that era's culture of surveillance has cast on our own time. Journalist Mark Paraskia spent years investigating the story behind A Spy in Canaan, a story about the double life of famed civil rights photographer Ernest Withers, and how a closely guarded government secret finally came to light. Today marks the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination, and Withers captured some of the most stunning moments of the civil rights era. From the age-defining snapshot of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. riding one of the first integrated buses in Montgomery, to the haunting photo of Emmett Till's great uncle pointing an accusing finger at his nephew's killers, Withers had a front-row seat to history as a man trusted and beloved by the movement's inner circle. However, few people knew that Withers was also an informant for the FBI, using his photos to help the Bureau identify and surveil the era's greatest figures. Memphis journalist Mark Paraskia broke the story of Withers' secret life after a long investigation, culminating in a landmark lawsuit against the government to release hundreds of once classified FBI documents. Again, the name of the book is A Spy in Canaan, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Paraskia to the roundtable this morning. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to this story?
Well, it all started many years ago, back in 1997. I've been a journalist in Memphis working for the Commercial Appeal since 1989. And back in that time, 97, James Earl Ray, King's assassin, was still alive, and I was covering his hearings. He was dying of liver disease and was trying to get out of prison and had filed a number of pleadings before the criminal court there in Shelby County. His lawyer in these pleadings was raising a number of conspiracy theories, and, you know, actually had written a book, and the King family came in and endorsed these theories, and King's younger son, Dexter, actually visited Ray in prison and shook his hand and said, you know, we believe you. We're going to do everything in our power to get you out of prison. So, I mean, it was just a really surreal moment. This story was being covered intensely nationally and internationally, so I had a lot of latitude at my paper to do things I normally wouldn't do, and I was looking into a lot of these different claims, and my work led me to, you know, I was interviewing police officers, former retired police officers, FBI agents, military intelligence, and there was an FBI agent, a retired agent who I talked to, who first brought up Ernest Withers, and I was asking him about if there was any electronic surveillance of Dr. King in the days before his death in Memphis, and he said, no, you know, we didn't do that there. He said, we didn't need it. We had so many good informants, you know, we had the place covered, and we're getting good information. And it was in that context that he brought up, you know, that Ernest had been an informant for the FBI. He said that he was a good informant, that, you know, he got reports and photos on all manner of activists either living in Memphis or passing through. And But he told me this confidentially. He would not go on the record. In fact, he said he would deny it if I ever wrote it. So, you know, when James Earl Ray died, you know, all of this stuff kind of died with him. You know, in the news business, we're constantly moving on to the next thing. And so, I really never looked back at that point. But it was only years later, in 2007, when Ernest died. After that, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request. And there were some records that I got through FOIA, as we call it, that focused on a period of Ernest's life after the civil rights era had waned. He had become a state policeman, a state liquor agent, and got caught up in some corruption and was the focus of an FBI investigation. And in those records, there was a background report referring to him. It said Ernest Columbus Withers was formally designated ME-338R. And I knew just enough at that point to recognize that as an informant number. You know, it's a code number. In the FBI jargon, they call it a source symbol number. And that started a whole chain of reactions where I eventually found other records from that period that had been released through FOIA where they made the same mistake. They were supposed to redact that. It's sensitive information, but they didn't. And, you know, this informant number is a unique identifier. Where you see it, you can just substitute in Ernest Withers' name. And I could identify a whole variety of things that he was doing for the FBI. That led to some stories. Then I eventually located the daughter of the FBI agent, Bill Lawrence, who had run Withers. Lawrence was dead by then, but his daughter had found in, among his personal effects and saved like handwritten notes that referred to Ernest by name and by code number. And that led to more stories. And then eventually, you know, we said, well, we want to get his informant file, my newspaper, and I sued the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act. And they fought us. They denied he had anything to do with them, you know. But eventually, you know, our case was so good, they had to admit in court that he was he'd been an informant. We got a mediated settlement that they paid all our attorney's fees back, or most of them, and we got all these records, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of records and photos documenting what he was doing for the FBI over a period of, from 1958 to 1976, 18 years. And so that's really the foundation of my book.
Let us go to the Ernest Withers and his story. So how does his story begin? Because do they come to him because of what he has accomplished, or does he start doing what he's doing because they ask him to?
Probably a little of both. But, you know, by that time, from 1958 to 1961, the records are kind of sketchy, and we don't really know exactly what he was doing for the FBI. But clearly by 1961, Bill Lawrence has recruited him because the movement is starting to blossom in the Memphis area. There are freedom riders coming home. There's unrest in the rural areas around there. The Nation of Islam has opened a mosque on Beale Street. And so by 1961, Ernest had well established his credentials as a civil rights photographer, essentially. His backstory basically is, you know, he was a World War II veteran. He fought in World War II. He was trained in the Army too. That's how he learned how his craft of photography. Came back home, opened a studio on Beale Street, shot everything from baby pictures to weddings, and he was at the same time a policeman for 3 years, from 1948 to 1951, walking a beat on Beale Street and around Memphis. And so he got to know everybody. And then he got fired from the force in 1951, and he really focused on his photography and went to work as a freelance photojournalist for the Tri-State Defender, which was the satellite operation of the Chicago Defender. And so, you know, in a matter of years then, while he's taking pictures, the civil rights movement really starts to take off. You know, Emmett Till is killed down in Mississippi, and he covers that. The Montgomery bus boycott happens in 1956, and he's taking all these wonderful pictures. I mean, he took this great picture of Dr. King riding one of the first integrated buses in Montgomery, and at the trial of Emmett Till's killers, took this haunting picture of Emmett's great uncle Moses Wright, you know, on the witness stand, pointing this accusing finger at the killers. He defied a judge's order to do it. He wasn't supposed to be taking pictures, but he did it. He starts building this resume and this reputation as this, you know, frontliner in the movement. And he has incredible access. Everybody knows him. He knows everybody, you know, in Memphis and the people who are coming through. And so it was these things that were going on that Bill Lawrence realized as they started bumping into each other, you know, as he was investigating, you know, militancy and communism in the movement. They start crossing paths, and they get to know each other, and they like each other. I mean, they had similar backgrounds. I mean, they were both Baptist. They both loved music. Bill Lawrence had a huge jazz collection that he used his love of music to build rapport with you know, other informants too. There was a man he recruited on the leadership of the NAACP in Memphis, and they both had huge jazz record collections, and they would swap records back and forth. So, I mean, Bill Lawrence had a big personality, affable guy. Ernest Withers was very similar. I think they liked each other, they hit it off, and Ernest had something that the FBI wanted, and it was that access to get inside these meetings, to get down into the grassroots of these foot soldiers and find out who they are, document them, you know, build these dossiers. They were trying to index the movement, and all of that started with a picture and then personal details like, you know, where they lived, who their relatives were, where they worked, who they associate with. And Ernest could deliver all of that to the FBI.
What impact do we know of his work? What impact did his work have on what the FBI was doing? They were looking for someone to infiltrate. They found someone. And with that information, they did what?
Well, they did a number of things. For one, they really were able to assess the potential of violence and unrest in the city. That was one thing. And they were able to build, these dossiers, all these individual files with personal and political data that they assembled. But, in addition to that, at times when they wanted to act against individuals, he could be helpful in that as well. One of the things that was going on in Memphis when you got to the late 60s, with all the unrest that was building there, you had riots across the country in Watts and Detroit and, other places, and they built all this level of paranoia. The Black Power movement was growing inside Memphis, and the FBI was very determined to undercut that movement. There was a homegrown Black Power organization called the Invaders, which was styled after SNCC and a bit later on after the Black Panthers. They had a variety of violent rhetoric that they were spewing, but they were largely benign. But nonetheless, there was this high level of paranoia, and the FBI just really focused on the Invaders. Their whole goal was to eviscerate them and undercut them, not only them, but their supporters and their sympathizers and associates. And in ways, this really was not unlike the McCarthyism era of, 10 years earlier, where they went after people who were just, sympathizers or associates. And I'll give you a couple examples of that. A man named Bobby Doctor, who was a civil rights activist out of South Carolina. He was engaged in the sit-in movements. He went to work in the mid-60s for the U.S. Civil Rights Commission and became a field rep in their office in Memphis. And Withers and some other informants start kicking back information to the FBI that he's associating, by 1967, 68 with Black Power militants. He's seen at meetings, he's seen at social gatherings doing this. And the FBI really goes after Bobby. At one point, Ernest gave them a photo. He said, "I saw Bobby at a march, and he's holding a woman's hand. And, Bobby's married, and the woman's married, but they ain't married to each other." And, of course, the FBI documents all this, gets the photo. They're really trying to undercut Bobby. At one point, the FBI shows up at his offices with a thick file of what he was doing and tries to get him fired. And they came close to doing it, too. Bobby survived. He went on to be the Southeast Regional Director of the Civil Rights Commission out of Atlanta for years, but is, quite embittered by this. And there were numbers of others where they went after them. The FBI feared them, thought that they were just too, labeled them as subversive communists. There was a communist party that had revived a youth organization, and they used Ernest in many ways to, go after these guys as well, getting photos, tips on what they were doing. They tried to get another guy fired, and at one point Ernest got his hands on information from his personnel file and told them, this is his home address, this is his social security number. Accurately reported the guy's social security number, and then two agents show up at the office, and mind you, this guy is just a truck driver. He's a guitar player who still plays in Memphis, by the way, a gifted flamenco guitarist. But back at the time, he was driving truck for a wrecking company, and they show up at his employer's office and tell him, hey, this guy's a communist, So there were a lot of things, a lot of dirty kind of things that were going on at the same time.
So on this 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., what do you think we should make of the legacy of Ernest Withers and his work with the FBI?
Well, I've said this many times, and in my view, there's nothing that he was doing for the FBI that eclipses the good that he did for the movement. I mean, when you look at these pictures that he took over and over and over again, they were so influential and so powerful to this day, timeless pictures, that what he did for the FBI didn't eclipse that, but but it does rival it. I mean, there's this hidden history of, you know, the Bureau going after individuals and building these files on so many people who, in so many instances, were engaged in nothing more than, you know, free speech, you know, exercising First Amendment rights, the right to protest, the right to dissent. And the government basically was going after them as enemies, very corrosive to democracy. And so I think this history, this hidden history, is very instructive for us today. There's always going to be this natural tension between law enforcement and people who are marching for their rights or standing up, you know, oppressed people, because the law enforcement people, they want to preserve the status quo. They want to, you know, preserve the stability, you know, the law and order of everything, and the people on the other side are, I mean, to a point, are trying to disrupt that. So, I mean, this is something that, you know, was a viable issue then, is a viable issue today, and will be, you know, 10, 20, 100 years from now.
The name of the book is A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement. The book is published by Melville House. Mark Paraskia is the author. Mark, thank you very much for sharing with us, and best of luck with the book.
Well, thank you so much.
Again, the name of the book is A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement. The book is published by Melville House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.